Blog Talk Radio.
If I ever do anything right, I wanna be so good to this little life. If I waking up night, I wanna know I tried my best for this little life. Oh, and time will tell, but my heart fell so hard, so there's nothing left but to love. Both my hands holding tight to this little life.
Progressive Parenting Radio is a production of Progressive Parenting Network and GinaKirby.com. No material on this radio program should be considered medical advice. This is a listener-funded program. And now, your host, Gina Kirby.
Being a parent is the hardest job you'll ever have. Progressive Parenting understands this and wants you to know that you're not alone. My name is Gina Kirby, and I am your humble host. I am not a parenting expert, but as a doula, childbirth educator, La Leche League International Breastfeeding Peer Counselor, and concerned parent of four children ages 12 years old through 19 months, I understand the difficulties involved with parenthood. So I'll be inviting doctors, nurses, family workers, authors, and experts from different fields to answer your parenting questions. Now, because this is a progressive talk show, we will broach topics and air opinions that you as a parent might not hear about through the mainstream media. The mission of progressive parenting is to inform, not preach, to share, not advise, and to connect, not alienate. Progressive Parenting Radio is a listener-funded program. If you enjoy the information we bring to you, please consider donating at progressiveparentingradio.com. Progressive Parenting Radio has been broadcasting for 9 years, bringing quality information to listeners like you. We would like to thank our listeners and our sponsors for supporting our mission. Many thanks to our sponsor, doulabook.com. The best doula websites are here. Doulabook wants you to know that they will be releasing Doulabook 3.0 very soon, so keep an eye out for what's coming up by going to doulabook.com. That's doulabook, all one word, .com. They're also releasing a new doula listing service, so go to Doulabook's Facebook page to learn more about what's going on there. The number to call in during the program is 347-840. The number to call in during the program, again, is 347-850-1642. So make sure that if you have a question, please be sure to press 1, and it will alert our producer that you have something to say. And now I am so pleased and very honored to introduce today's guest. Dr. Rian Eisler is a cultural historian, system scientist, educator, attorney, speaker, and author whose work on cultural transformation has inspired scholars and social activists. Her research has impacted many fields, including history, literature, philosophy, art, economics, psychology, sociology, education, organizational development, political science, and healthcare. She's the author of many books, which we will be talking about today. And I, without any further hesitation, would love to introduce her to you. Thank you, Dr. Eisler, for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you. I wanted to ask you, what an amazing life you've led. I'm wondering, how did your journey begin? How did you get into this life of economics and psychology and sociology and healthcare? How did you end up where you are today?
Well, I have, I sometimes say that my life is like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle coming together, because so many events really that at one point may not have seemed related to others, I came together to do it. I mean, it started really when I was very, very small, as a very young child. My parents and I had to flee from Europe from the Nazis, and we were really the only members of our extended family, my parents and I, who managed to escape, and most of them were killed by the Nazis in the Holocaust. So very early, of course, I had to ask myself this question, does there have to be so much cruelty, insensitivity, violence, or are there alternatives? And I really didn't know that that would be my life's work. But through many other things, it just came together that way. First, I studied sociology and anthropology, of course, to try to answer those questions. Didn't really give me the answers. I also went to the UCLA Law School, became an attorney, and became very involved in women's and children's human rights work through that background. I also have a background in systems science. So anyway, it all came together, and I did end up in my last book, well, of course, my best-known book is The Chalice and the Blade, Our History, Our Future, which is now in 26 foreign languages.
Oh, wow.
But I did end up by, as you said, writing about economics in my book, The Real Wealth of Nations, because economics, how we structure economics and what we consider valuable in our economic systems, really has to change.
Yes, I was watching a TEDx that you did and talking about how our the GNP, what's in it, and that there are a lot of things that we would consider negatives that they count as positives, and they don't count at all our women's quality of life. And I'd like to hear more about that. I'd like to share with our listeners about that. You had shared a story about, I believe you had said it was Switzerland, or I think I better let you tell the story about how,
okay,
how they figured in the quality of life and what that meant to them and for them.
Well, I'm glad you watched that TEDx program, because it really, I start by pointing out, as you said, that the measure that our policymakers rely on the most, which is gross domestic or gross national product, actually is so flawed that it includes negatives as productive. So, mm-hmm. for example, selling and making cigarettes or fast foods that cause all kinds of diseases, right, as mm-hmm. well as the health costs and the funeral costs caused by all that, are on the plus side of GDP. I mean, which is crazy, isn't it? But
yes.
Not only does it have negatives, but it fails to include, and this is really something that we're working to change, the value of this most important human work, the work of caring for people, starting in early childhood, right, parenting, child care. If it's done in the home, it is not even visible at all. And if it's in the market, because we so devalue that, really, as a society, we may talk about motherhood and apple pie, but mm-hmm. in reality, the proof of the of it all is that child care workers in our wealthy nation earn less than dog walkers. And I mean, I love dogs, but it's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. Well, that goes, that is crazy. And it's so true. And these are people who are caring for our children and our future. And
yeah. And so, but we are the only, we at the Center for Partnership Studies have launched our major program is the Caring Economy Campaign. And it's mm-hmm. designed to change our policies. I mean, look, we developed new measures, new metrics that are very different from GDP, measures that really look and compare our nation, the United States, both in terms of the human capacity development, which is what's the result, right? We know from neuroscience that early care, well, you know this very well, you know, early care is foundational to whether or not we develop fully or even halfway or even one-third, right? Or very little. And but it is not considered in our policies. So we also look at how do we compare as a nation with other so-called developed nations, wealthier nations, in our investment in family support, in high-quality child care availability. We as a nation invest less than half of the average of other such nations. And we're the only nation in this group that does not have federally funded, government-funded, paid parental leave. And so we're working to change that. And for those of our listeners who are interested, please go to caringeconomy.org, www.caringeconomy.org. And we also have webinars that are just wonderful webinars that really help us become advocates for what we so need. And some of them actually are free webinars. We have one on November the 12th at 11 a.m. Pacific time on the Caring Economy Campaign, and that one is free for 1 hour. So please do join us, and you can do so on the website.
And just a note, I made sure to take a note of that, and I put caringeconomy.org at the Progressive Parenting Facebook site. So if any of you were rushing around trying to find a pen, don't worry. You can just go to Progressive Parenting Radio, and you can find a link there and take advantage of this. This sounds wonderful. I know I'm going to.
Great. Well, you know, it's just that we are really, none of our political candidates are even talking about this issue.
No. No
one. And we've got to change that because the media won't talk about it unless they do, right? It's sort of a catch-22, isn't it? And so people really don't know this, and they don't know what's possible, and they don't know, for example, because you mentioned some nations, nations like Sweden, Finland, Norway, who were pioneers, really, in paid parental leave for both mothers and fathers, by the way, which is what we need. They have a much higher general standard of living. There aren't these huge gaps that we have in our wealthy nation between those on top and those on bottom. So it isn't, again, the conversation about corporations is part of it, but that's the tip of the iceberg. The hidden part of the iceberg is that we don't make it possible for people to really both earn a living in the market and at the same time care for their families, for their children, for their elderly.
Well, that
has to change.
Right, exactly. And it does. And that was the question I was going to ask you. Is it in this country, do you believe that we really value parenting?
Well, do we? I mean, if we don't even, if we're the only nation that does not have paid parental leave, doesn't that speak very loudly about the hypocrisy of saying that we do? And fortunately, of course, there is beginning to be a big conversation about this, but it, as I said, it hasn't reached the political discourse. It's sort of ghettoized, isn't it, as a, quote, women's issue. Well, and the reason that it's so devalued, of course, is goes very deep, because we also, as a culture, And this is not just the United States, of course. I mean, other nations, you know, women are horribly subordinate. I mean, when you look at some of the Middle East, right, you know, it's a disaster. And it goes along with a very low quality of life for most of the population, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
So, if we're going to change all this, and if we're going to really, I mean, you have to start looking at factors that aren't looked at. If you look at the disproportionate poverty, for example, of women, where the U.S. Census figures, I mean, most people don't know this, but according to the U.S. Census Bureau, women of all races, in the United States, women over 65 are twice as likely to live in poverty as men of the same age. And one of the main reasons for this is that most of these women are or were either full or part-time caregivers, either for no pay, right, in families and no support from the community, from the government, or if they're in the market, and there's a disproportionate number of women of color in the market who do this work, which is another reason for the terrible disproportionate poverty of communities of color in our nation. So we have to start looking at things that we're not used to looking at and changing them and working to change awareness and move then to action, to different policies.
Right, and maybe stop calling them women's issues and more focusing on the fact that these are all human rights.
Absolutely. These are basic human issues. And, I mean, the good news is that more men are beginning to, well, you know, the old stereotype of the real man, right? Is, you know, well, he wouldn't, above all, he's not going to be like a woman, right? And yet you see so many men today who are diapering babies, who are feeding babies, you know, doing the so-called women's work, redefining fathering to look more like what used to be just mothering, right? So there is change, and we have to work with enlightened men. And fortunately, you know, there are more of them who really want to do this. But again, we've got to change the awareness of the value of women and so-called women's work, whether it's performed by women or men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the value of it, indeed. And that's the thing that we're not doing, and that's what I really enjoyed, The Real Wealth of Nations, because it really put economics on its head for me from what I had learned about it in college.
Well, I think we need to stand it. I think what we're taught really is upside down, and that the real wealth of nations, as you said, it kind of stands it so that it's heads up. Mm-hmm. And we have to start with the question, what do we really value? I mean, one, certainly subsistence, certainly economics, but the premise, you see, of what I call domination economics is scarcity. But the system itself creates artificial scarcity. I mean, think about it. The concentration of wealth in the hands of a few on top creates scarcity. The disproportionate investment in weaponry. I mean, we need weapons. I am, you know, I'm a Holocaust survivor. I know that we need to have an adequate defense against societies that orient more to what I call a domination system, okay? Like the Nazis did, like some of the nations in our world do today, many of them. But at the same time, it's crazy, you know? We have a completely crazy system of values. I mean, in terms of the title of my book, The Chalice and the Blade, we invest so much more in the blade, the power to take life, than in the chalice, the power to give and nurture and support and really make life meaningful, which is the chalice, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And that would lead to the second question, which I guess we've already answered, but do we really value birthing in our culture?
Well, you know, I have to laugh when I hear that because obviously we don't.
Yes.
And obviously it's not valued in no cultures that orient to the domination side is it valued. I mean, it's a matter of degree, isn't it? I should say that my work identifies, based on a cross-cultural multidisciplinary study, two underlying human possibilities, what I call the partnership model and the domination model. But the point of it is, when I was doing research for one of my books, which is really one of my favorites, Sacred Pleasure is the name of the book, and the subtitle is Sex, Myth, and the Politics of the Body. And I was just shocked when I realized that in earlier societies that oriented more to the partnership side of the continuum, like a very large society in Europe, well, actually in Turkey, in Anatolia, called Çatalhöyük, about 6,000 years ago, they found sculptures, artworks of and the art was part of the sacred, because, you know, until very recent times, most art dealt with the sacred, right? It was of a woman giving birth, was part of the sacred imagery. There's this so-called, this woman sitting on a throne, possibly a goddess figure, and she's honored for giving birth. But think of all the images we've grown up with of, inflicting pain, suffering pain, whether it's in the Mahabharata in India of all of these deities fighting and killing each other, whether it's all of the, you know, so-called martyrs and saints, right? You know, suffering. Taking life is really what's, or the heroic, you know, warrior, so to speak, right?
Yes.
Slaying the dragon, et cetera. So again, we're back to the chalice and the blade, aren't we? And
yes.
So if you think about it for a moment, that it wasn't until about, two decades ago that the image of a pregnant woman could be seen on the media or in classrooms. I mean, women were not, this was considered obscene.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's obscene to show killings all the time, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, the dominant model is that of warfare being celebrated at every turn, and then you have a pregnant Lucille Ball being hidden by furniture in the program, because it was obscene to be with child, even though she was a married woman. And even, like you just said, up until 2 decades ago, you didn't see it. I remember when I saw Demi Moore on the cover of Vanity Fair, pregnant and just covered in paint, and what an uproar that caused. And I thought, I remember being very affected by that, because I thought, what's the big deal? And I couldn't understand why everyone was so mortified by her pregnant body.
This is it. I mean, we don't value birthing. We don't value, and it's women, it's life-giving, it's birthing. At the same time, and I really want to be clear here, women have to have reproductive freedom, because one of the major cornerstones of a domination system is rigid male dominance, including the denial to women of access to family planning, access to abortion. I mean, and it continues in the world today. And I'm just hoping that this new pope will eventually, it's doubtful that he will, with all of his wonderful, more humanity, somehow it seems to stop. mean, if you talk about the environment today, I mean, let's just broaden the picture here.
Mm-hmm.
Our real problem is population. I mean, 7 billion people on this finite planet, but mm-hmm. And we know that the only way that we can really have a higher quality of life for everybody depends on women being given reproductive freedom, being given education, being given other life choices, and being breeders of sons for men, which is still what they're valued for in so many world regions today, you know, Africa, the Middle East, Latin America. That norm has to change. And it has changed. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I would hear people saying, "Hope next time it's a boy," when a girl was born. Well, nobody would say that anymore today, would they?
No, not to
so
me anyway.
So we can change the norms.
Right. Well, that's the thing, too. You were talking about women having rights, reproductive rights, the rights to just their bodies in general. Women do not lose their basic human rights once they become pregnant. And yet, across the globe, women's human rights are compromised and violated around the time of childbirth. Where, yes, we have overpopulation, but if you do become pregnant, it shouldn't mean that you lose your basic right. There are examinations, interventions, there's procedures that pose risks to moms and babies, and their babies are routinely have routines performed on them without informed consent or coerced compliance and threats and through fear. And I think that's why it's a really good idea, like you said, to stop not making them women's rights, but making it a human rights issue. There's a wonderful group called humanrightsandchildbirth.org who are working really hard at turning the spotlight on to what happens to women and their children, and are saying very loudly that it makes a big difference. Caring about the status of women is important. And that's what I love about your book and also going back to the Real Wealth of Nations in that way.
Well, I'm so glad you have this group. You may be interested in some of, because I have been writing about this for a long time, and my latest work on is called Protecting the Majority of Humanity, and it's about using international law, like the Rome Statute section on crimes against humanity, to protect women's rights. And children's rights across the globe by holding government officials at all levels accountable. And you can find that article. It's called Protecting the Majority of Humanity. It's in a Cambridge University Press book on my website, which is rianeisler.com. No period, just Rian with two E's in the middle. Rian, R-I-A-N-E.
Yeah.
EISLER.com. But, you know, I'm so glad you have this group, and I think perhaps this work can be of use to you, because we know that, one of the rights that is being violated, of course, is access to family planning.
Yeah.
Just as the fact that, for example, child brides, you know, across the globe are a horrific risk for pregnancy, and yet it continues and people still justify it as moral, right?
Yeah.
Controlling women is considered normal and moral, and mm-hmm. that has to change. So you're so right, so much. But the good thing is we're having these conversations, and I really want to congratulate you for being, really so much of a leader in the conversation.
Oh my goodness, I'd like to pretend you didn't say that, because I don't know what to say to that.
Well, you just say thank you.
Thank you.
That's one thing, too. We women, they've done studies, and it's really interesting in terms of how women learn to devalue themselves. If you ask a man in these studies why he succeeded, he'll say, well, you know, I did this and this and I did that and that. And if you ask a woman, she'd say, well, I was lucky and I, yeah. So, yeah, so I want to honor you.
Thank you so much.
And have you honor yourself.
Well, I will, and thank you very much. And like I said at the very beginning of the program, I'm very honored to have you on the show. Please talk to my listeners more about a partnership model of society. You were saying earlier about how we have these men now who, like an example, my husband right now is caring for the children so that I can do the radio program without screaming and hollering and banging on the door. and he's a diaper changer. He's a stay-at-home father. He works from home while I travel the world teaching about childbirth. And he's a nurturer. And I want for you to share, and there's more and more men like him everywhere. I know, I've met them. There's a new way to look at things, and I want you to talk about your partnership model of society and what that is. You just touched on it, but I would love for a little more detail from my listeners.
Well, we are so used to thinking of societies, aren't we, in terms of religious or secular or Eastern or Western, Northern or Southern, capitalist or socialist, right or left. And these are interesting categories, but the only thing about it is that they don't tell us anything, do they, about how a culture structures these fundamental human relations between the female and male half of humanity and between them and their daughters and sons. I mean, think about it. And if you don't really understand how those relations and roles are socially constructed and how they can vary, right? You know, we just talked about it, how they're beginning to change a little bit in a partnership direction, then you miss the point of what I said about neuroscience, that nothing less than how our brains develop is very, very directly shaped by what kinds of relations children experience or observe early on, right?
Yeah.
So the partnership model and the domination model are integrated. They take this into account, and they transcend the conventional categories. So they show connections that are otherwise invisible. For example, the connection between whether a society condones violence in families and whether they are or are not very warlike and aggressive. And, of course, you see that, don't you? I mean, if you look at some of the... well, look at ISIS, for example, okay?
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, a complete subordination of women. They may have to make themselves invisible, even. So you know, if somebody's invisible, they have no human rights. They're not human. Children, I mean, they're socialized through violence. I mean, that's really... So that's what you get. You get very violent and very, you know, you get terror. You get post-traumatic stress, don't you, as the norm. So that's the domination system at its extreme. But we still carry elements of that. Remember I said that there were earlier societies, and you really, I mean, we need to look at our history. I invite our listeners to really go to my website, RianEisler.com, and you'll see a whole sequence of books on education, books on, well, as I said, sacred pleasure and sexuality and spirituality, The Chalice and the Blade, The Real Wealth of Nations. My latest book, actually, I wrote with a former PhD student of mine who now teaches nursing at the University of Minnesota, and it's about transforming interprofessional teams. You know, that's the big trend in healthcare, right?
Yeah.
So I really recommend, it just won 2 awards, 1 national and 1 international one.
Uh-huh.
But I suggest you go to my website, RianEisler.com, and really use that information. Use that information because what it's all about is shifting from entrenched traditions of domination in all of our institutions, from the family, religion, education, to politics and economics, to a more partnership oriented societies. And yes, one of the cornerstones is gender relations, and as well as childhood experiences. That's another cornerstone. So it's a whole different, more integrated and more realistic way of looking at how we can really change our lives and those of our children and future generations for the better.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, can you touch on, I wish we could talk for hours and hours, the difference. You said that in an interview, I remember hearing you say that the people think that there's matriarchy and there's patriarchy, and that that the opposite of patriarchy is matriarchy, but that's not necessarily true.
Well, it isn't true at all, because if you look at it semantically, whether it's controlled by fathers or controlled by mothers, isn't that two sides of a domination coin?
Yeah.
And we're trapped by our language, aren't we, into thinking there are only two alternatives. You either dominate or you're dominated. And the reality, as we're beginning to see, as you just described in your family, there is a partnership alternative. And it does start with the socialization of both women and men. You know, they're two halves of humanity. So when we're talking about female and male socialization, aren't we talking about socialization for being human, right? And in the old model, both women and men are in straitjackets, denied of their full humanity. Men in the domination system are denied of access to some of the qualities that make us fully human. Empathy, sensitivity, caring, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the 9/11 terrorists had left a will saying that his mother should not be permitted at his funeral, lest she pollute it with her, quote, femininity. I mean, that's how deep in these rigid domination cultures that contempt for the so-called soft or feminine goes, okay? And women, of course, are denied of our full humanity because we're not supposed to be, if a man is assertive, that's great. If a woman is assertive, she's a bitch, right?
Right.
Which is crazy. So women are beginning to enter leadership roles. Men are beginning to enter caregiving roles. That's the movement towards partnership at its most basic. And so is the movement toward really nonviolent and connected parenting. You know, that's basic, and that's something that we're also very engaged in at the Center for Partnership Studies. I mean, you know, remember we were talking about some of the nations I don't think I ever finished that conversation, so let me get back to it.
Yeah.
I was talking about nations like Sweden, Finland, and Norway. They not only have more caring policies, paid parental leave, very generous paid parental leave, and all of that, but they also have been in the forefront of two vital areas. One, they were the first nation who passed laws saying that discipline based on force of children is against the law. Think about that.
Wow.
I mean, wow. And also they've been trying to have a very strong men's movement to disentangle so-called masculinity from its association in domination systems. You know, real men, they're violent, they love to fight, they're hard, they're not soft. And so they're in the forefront of this. It all goes together. I mean, the fact that they have women are 40-50% of their national legislatures. We're way behind. And the fact that they have more caring policies goes together, because as the status of women rises, men are able to also embrace more stereotypically feminine traits and activities. I mean, men couldn't be diapering and feeding babies if it hadn't been for the feminist movement, frankly.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, because it was only as the status of women began to rise that men no longer felt so devalued, so threatened in their identity as men, right?
Yes.
So, my work is about connecting the dots in different ways, and that's what we all have to do.
Yeah, and that's what I'm hoping that we can get to. I want it all to go faster, don't we all? For our society to find these changes, societies adhering closely to that domination system, like you say on your website, they have control in both the family and the state or tribe, and then you say the subordination of the female half of humanity to the male half. And with this, the devaluation of caring, nonviolence, and other stereotypically soft values in women and men, a high degree of institutionalized or built-in fear, coercion, and violence. And that's what we see in our work. When I say we, I mean childbirth advocates, who we see a lot of coercion, fear, and violence. And for a lot of listeners, it's hard to believe, but there's such thing as obstetric violence that happens to women. And women can come out of childbirth with postpartum, with PTSD from the disrespect, abuse, again, obstetric violence. And there's this whole idea that the goal is just, you know, healthy mother, healthy baby. As long as you're both alive after the baby's born, that's all that matters. And I believe that comes from that adhering to that domination system. And I can't wait till we, you know, do the work that we have to do so that our society can adhere more closely to the partnership system, where we have more democratic organization in the family and in our tribes, and that things are softer, more stereotypically feminine, and we have a low degree of institutionalized or fear-based coercion. That's the dream.
Well, and that's the goal. That's the goal. And, you know, if we don't have... We wouldn't build a house, would we, without building foundations for it. And these relations are foundational. How do we value? Do we equally value both halves of humanity or not? I mean, that's basic, isn't it? Because if children grow up with that notion that one half of our species is inferior and the other half is superior, one half is to be dominated, the other half is to dominate, one half is to be served, and the other half is to serve, they have a map, don't they, in their minds, deeply entrenched, to equate any difference, whether it's based on race or religion or ethnicity, on the same principles, don't they? So we've got to start thinking differently. This is a time, thank goodness, because of the dislocation of first the Industrial Revolution and then now the move into the post-industrial revolution, where we have an opening because things aren't working. You know, the old stuff just isn't working. But we have to be very careful that the system doesn't reconstruct itself along the old principles. And that's up to us, isn't it?
Yeah. How about it? All of these things that we've come to learn in our culture are so incredibly ingrained. I mean, look at just the example of a few minutes ago when you gave me a compliment and I had a really hard time accepting it. that's some deep-rooted stuff. And here I am, this free-thinking, quote-unquote, feminist woman who can't take a compliment. So that's some deep-rooted, you know, patriarchal ideals.
Absolutely. I didn't say it was going to be, but actually it is easy in a way, because once you become aware of it, mm-hmm. that you carry that inner voice, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then when you hear it, you can say, wait a minute, hey, I don't have to listen to you.
Yes, that voice is not mine.
Yeah. You know, I wrote, I do want to tell you about a book that I wrote that's very practical, very hands-on, and it's called The Power of Partnership. And it applies all of these principles to seven relationships: how we relate to ourselves, our intimate family and other relations, work and community relations, but then it also relates it to how we relate nationally, internationally, to nature, and what kind of spirituality we have internalized, you know?
So yes.
I really recommend The Power of Partnership. A lot of people are using it in workshops, and it occurs to me that your wonderful group might want to do some workshops based on it.
That sounds amazing. I will be sure to let them know all about this. I hope they're listening. Absolutely. Wow. I just want to go on and on about all of these different topics with you. I love your idea from the very beginning that you had started asking yourself this question, like, do we really have to live this way sent from a very young age? And I love that the answer is no.
Well, and that is really something we have to address, because so many of the myths, I mean, you were talking about deeply ingrained,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it's the story of original sin, which is a really bizarre story. St. Augustine decided that every child is born tainted by what he considered Adam and Eve's original sin, just by the act of being born. I mean, right there, you know, there's no escape, right? But it's perpetuated today by popular stories about selfish genes, you know, that push us, right, to be completely ruthless, which is absolute nonsense, because what we know about biological evolution is that there's a movement towards greater consciousness, towards greater empathy, towards greater caring. I mean, the mammals don't survive, right, without care.
Right.
So, but see, what we're really talking about is putting reality from its upside down to right side up. And it's a fascinating process that actually entails what I write about in The Chalice and the Blade and in Sacred Pleasure particularly, re-mything, really looking at our old mythologies and saying, wait a minute, those came out of domination-oriented, very domination-oriented systems, okay?
Yeah.
And they maintain them, don't they? So we have to know there is an alternative, not perfect. I mean, for example, I really want to say something very, very, very important. There are hierarchies in partnership systems. You know, we need parents, right? We need teachers, we need managers, we need leaders, but there's a difference. And again, we need a new vocabulary. And I've called one hierarchies of domination. Okay, well, we know those, you know. You better obey or else, you know, you lose your job, you lose your life, you get beaten or whatever, right? But there's also the alternative of hierarchies of actualization, where power is power with and power to. I mean, that's the norm, you know, the ideal norm, rather than power over. And here, accountability, respect, benefits don't just flow from the bottom up, but both ways. So it's we talk today about authoritative rather than authoritarian child rearing, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the hierarchy of actualization. We talk about the manager no longer being the cop, the controller, but somebody who inspires, who elicits from others their highest potentials. That's a hierarchy of actualization. But putting it into practice, I mean, we're just learning, aren't we? We're just beginning, but we have to understand that there is an alternative. That's the first step.
Well, I think that's reassuring, for sure. And you don't have to see the entire staircase, right? You just take the first step. That's what we have to do.
Well, that's why the power of, I was going to say, that's why I start in the power of partnership with how we relate to ourselves.
Ah.
Because that's really the first step, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, well, we have to start there, and then we can move on, and then we can change the world.
Well, And change is a constant. The only issue is whether it's going to be transformative or not. Or whether the domination system rebuilds itself. You know, be it through so-called religious fundamentalism, which is really domination fundamentalism, when you come right down to it. Because religion can have, well, at the core of all the world's religions are partnership teachings, right? Caring, empathy. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But I really want to emphasize, we're not talking about an ideal society. We're talking about moving to the partnership side of the continuum. And we're beginning to do that. So it's up to us to enlist more people in that exciting movement.
Mm. I have one more question for you, and it really wasn't, I did not write this question down. This is from a friend of mine said, you should ask this question. How does your current work on economics relate to your previous research into the history of the divine feminine?
Well, it's really interesting because Archbishop Desmond Tutu wrote about the real wealth of nations, that this is a way of structuring economics that meets both our material and our spiritual needs. And it does directly relate to my work because, of course, the divine feminine, the whole notion that women can be part of the priesthood. You know, if men were denied entry into the priesthood, they would be denied moral authority, wouldn't they? Including the moral authority to say this is right and this is wrong, including what's done to them, right? Women have been denied this. So I'm very careful in my work. I'm not an essentialist. I don't think that women are better than men. I don't think that we have these innate differences. Yes, maybe in evolution, because women give and nurture life, we have more of a capacity for learning nurturance, but some women don't, by the way, and some men do, and a lot of men do. All men can learn to be nurturing. It's a whole redefinition of spirituality, isn't it? I mean, in an economics, in a caring economy, caring, which is fundamental to the divine feminine, isn't it, is honored. And that makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So it's completely related, even though in the real wealth of nations, because it's for a different audience, I don't go into that. But thank your friend for asking.
I just dropped off for a second there. Hello?
I'm here.
I said
thank your friend for asking.
Oh. I will indeed. I want to thank you so much for being on the program today and for all the work that you've done and that you are continuing to do. And I just thank you deeply. It means so much to me and has made a big impact on me. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, it was my pleasure, Gina, and keep up your wonderful work because your work is about shifting from domination to partnership, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Well, have a wonderful rest of the day.
You too, and I hope to speak again soon.
I would love that. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Then to our listeners, I can't tell you, wow, what a treat that was. I'm sorry. I'm trying really hard, tried the whole time not to fangirl super hard. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I'd like to thank our sponsor again, our doulabook.com, the best doula website. If you want the best doula website, then start here. Doula Book wants you to know that they'll be releasing Doula Books 3.0 very soon. Keep an eye out for what's going on by going to doulabook.com. And they've also just released a doula listing service, so go to Doula Book Facebook page to learn more. And that's Doula Book, all one word, on Facebook and doulabook.com. We may not have reached our fundraising goal, but no worries. We still have a donate button. Google Help Progressive Parenting GoPro, or you can just go to progressiveparentingradio.com and hit the donate button. You can come see me. I'll be in Portland, Oregon on November the 14th and 15th. We're doing a Flock Yeah there. It's a mini birth conference, open to midwives, doulas, hopeful doulas, birth nerds, and parents. And our next program, you have to be sure to join us for our next show, which is Monday, November 9th at 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. I will be joined by Sarah Buckley. Dr. Sarah Buckley will be in our program. And then on Wednesday, November 11th, Lou Hennessian will be joining me live at 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. I do hope you'll join us. And until next time, take care of yourselves and take care of each other.
If I ever do anything right, I wanna be so good to this little life. If I ever wake in the night, I wanna know I tried my best for this little life.
Okay, keep your eyes closed.
Okay.
I want to show you my first ever painting.
All right.
Okay. Open your eyes.
Oh, that's a lot of colors and shapes.
So be honest. What do you think?
Well, I like how if you switch to Geico, you could save hundreds of dollars on car insurance.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Here, why don't I hold your paintbrush while you call them?
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.